The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 325. Joseph S. Smith, The Formative Years, 1838 to 1867, by Scott King, with comments by Kathleen Flake.
Well, I covered this morning in the Tribune, so I think we can go right to the questions.
We note that these events occurred, or we can speculate about what might have been his reaction. I hope today you will bear with me as I pursue the latter alternative. And I might mention now that Kathleen is back that she will not recognize this paper, but she may have a vague recollection of some of its content, for which I apologize. The three events to which I refer are his father's death when he was 5, his mother's death when he was 13, and the failure of his first marriage when he was 29. The death of a father is an important event for any 5-year-old. And if by murder, it is all the more traumatic. Anger would not be an unusual response for a 5-year-old, particularly when the entire community reinforced those feelings with expressions of outrage. It would not be unexpected if the boy became quick to blame others, was always on the outlook for enemies, and subject to outbursts of anger. These, I think, are the normal response range, or within the normal response range, and all are manifest in Joseph F.'s youth and with some diminution in his later life. The death of his mother, which left him an orphan, must have been even more traumatic. She was only 51, and it was generally assumed her death was hastened by hardship and deprivation. I think Joseph F.'s sense of anger and resentment was only amplified by her death. He had been powerless to do anything about his father's murder. He was too young to prevent it or take revenge. He was powerless to do anything about his mother's death. The third event, divorce, is almost always a heartrending affair, often accompanied by guilt, shame, and blame. All three were present in Joseph F.'s case. His wife, Levira, laid out his shortcomings to Brigham Young less than a year after he was ordained an apostle. President Young had married them for time and all eternity, but they couldn't make it work. I think Joseph knew that there was failure on both sides, but ultimately he dealt with it by assigning responsibility to his wife's independent, rebellious nature, her failure to support him, and her lack of faith. At least that's how he would see it, I believe. They separated in June 1867. And 5 years later, the juvenile instructor published what I believe is the first sketch of Joseph F.'s childhood recollections. The article is based on an 11-page manuscript in his own handwriting and was written, I assume, the same year the article was published, 1872. The manuscript is really a family myth, based on fact but serving a higher purpose. Hiram is all but ignored. His status is already established, and Joseph F. has nothing to offer concerning him. What he can contribute is a story of his mother, savior of Hiram's family, and paragon of womanly virtues. Mary Fielding, a convert from Toronto, married Hiram in 1837, right after the death of his first wife. Instantly, Mary had 5 children to raise. She gave birth to Joseph F. less than a year later, a couple of weeks after the Hans Mill massacre, and a few days after the arrest of Hiram that would eventually take him to Liberty Jail. Mary was very sick, but insisted she be taken to Liberty to show Hiram their new son. I think it worth noticing that the first meeting between Hiram and Joseph F., the then current patriarch and the future president of the church, occurred in jail, which was the consequence of persecution, a common theme in both of their lives. Soon after her return to Far West, Mary's home was ransacked by a mob. One Harlow Redfield, a visiting member of the church, helped the mob get into Hiram's trunk. "I well remember," Joseph F. writes, "when in 1851 or 52, Redfield came to Utah, and he came to my mother and endeavored to explain matters, saying that he endeavored to pick the lock so that the mob should not break it. However satisfactory this explanation, my mother could not swallow it, as she plainly told him. As Brother Redfield died in the church, I should like to think well of him. But this I must say, however pure his motives, my mother would never acknowledge his explanation of the deed. Interestingly, Joseph first wrote, mother would never acknowledge a forgiveness of the deed, and then changed it to his explanation of the deed. I think the change of two words speaks volumes about both Mary and her son. Forgiveness did not come easily to either. After the Far West incident in 1839, Joseph skips to winter quarters, 1846-47. In so doing, he omits the information that before leaving Nauvoo, Mary married Heber C. Kimball. This was one of those marriages which only meant that the women had someone they could turn to in times of need. It was not particularly germane to the story Joseph was telling, but does have some minor relevance to ours. In fact, I can find no reference where he ever indicates that he was technically the stepson of Heber C. Kimball, or that Heber C. Kimball had married Mary Fielding. He relates two incidents from winter quarters. In the first, Mary's intuition or inspiration prevents a band of rustlers stealing their cattle. In the second, 9-year-old Joseph skillfully outmaneuvers a band of Indians to save the animals until help arrives. By the spring of 1848, Mary and the family were desperate to get out of winter quarters, but many of their cattle and horses had died, so they were obliged to press young steers and other ill-suited animals into service. It took them 3 days to get to the staging grounds at Elk Horn, a prohibitively slow rate of travel. At that point, Joseph writes, a circumstance occurred I shall never forget and have not yet even forgiven. The family was assigned to Cornelius P. Lott's company. Learning of their condition, Lott declared that it was folly for Widow Smith to attempt the journey, and said he, go back to winter quarters and remain till another year so that you can get assistance. For if you start out in this manner, you will be a burden on the company the whole way, and I will have to carry you along or leave you on the way. To this disconsolate harangue, Mother calmly replied, Father Lott, I will beat you to the valley and will ask no help from you either. At this, he seemed quite nettled and said sharply, you can't get there without help, and the burden will be on me, and turned on his heel and went away. I was then a little boy, and I felt grieved and hurt at the harsh and disencouraging manner of Father Lott and the cold rebuff he gave my mother. But Mary managed to contract for additional oxen, so when the company rolled out, they were ready. The popular story about anointing the six sick oxen comes next. In this manuscript version, I think, is the original version. Interestingly, the import of the story seems not to emphasize the power of faith, but the resentment Lott harbored toward Mary Smith. One of our best oxen laid down in the yoke as if poisoned, and all supposed he would die. Father Lott now blustered about as if the world would come at an end. There, he said, I told you you would have to be helped and that you would be a burden on the company. But in this he was mistaken, for after praying for the ox and pouring oil upon him, he got up and we drove along, only detaining the company a very short time. But we had not gone far when another fell down like the first. But with the same treatment, he got up as the other. I believe this was repeated the third time, to the astonishment of all who saw, and the chagrin of Brother Lott. Soon, three of Lott's oxen and his best mule died, and he was obliged to get help in order to proceed. I haven't got into the good part yet.
There's the lights.
Okay. I heard him say, It looks suspicious that four of my best animals should lie down in this manner all at once and die, and everybody's cattle but mine escape, and insinuated that somebody had poisoned them through spite, all of which was said in my presence and for my especial benefit, which I perfectly understand, although he did not address himself directly to me. It was well for Father Lot I was only a stripling 9 years of age and not a man. Even 4 years later, such an occurrence would have cost the old man dearly, regardless of his age. Note the allusion to 4 years later. That was the year Mary Fielding died. My temper was beyond boiling, he continues. It was white hot, for I knew his insinuation was directed or aimed at my mother. At this moment, I resolved on revenge for this and the many other insults and abuses the old fiend had heaped upon my mother, and should most certainly have carried out my resolution had not death come timely to my relief and rid the earth of so vile and despicable an encumbrance while I was yet a child. When his mother died, it appears from this rendering, Joseph F. was so angry he would have killed the man who only harassed his mother. Was this anger based on any real harm done to Mary? Or was it perhaps the expression of free-floating anger over the loss of his mother and Joseph's need to blame someone for his hurt and to do something about it? What purpose is served by dredging up these old wounds when both Redfield and Lot are long since gone to the grave? Why, when he could have written about so many other things, did Joseph F. choose to recall stories of betrayal, insult, and anger? I suggest his deep-seated anger was based on his parents' death, especially his mother's, and that anger and his lust for revenge affected his life well after 1872, when he wrote this article, or this manuscript. The manuscript is not complete, but in the published article that was based on the manuscript, Mary fulfills her prediction by beating Brother Lot to the valley by day. So it has really mythical connotations all the way through it, which I haven't addressed, but I think are interesting. The family spent the winter in their wagons inside the fort, a few blocks from here. And in the spring of 1849, they commenced work on an adobe house roughly 6 miles from here at what is now 27th South and 13th East. Mary was given a city lot half a block from the current Sunstone offices. But she chose to raise her family in the relatively isolated Mill Creek area. Then in the summer of 1852, she became seriously ill and was taken to Heber C. Kimball's home, and it was there she died 2 months later. When Joseph heard the news, he passed out. It was a tragic loss, and with his mother gone, his 19-year-old stepbrother, John, became head of the family. The two did not get along. Then there was Joseph's sister, Mary Ann, three older stepsisters, and an infirm old blind man who had been with the family many years. So we had six teenagers, one preteen, and an infirm man in a one-room cabin that had an open loft. The winters must have been especially difficult. It was also the only time of year Joseph attended school. From 1850 to 1854, he accumulated a total of 3 months of formal education. I suppose everyone knows the story of how he was expelled for thrashing the teacher who attempted to physically discipline Martha Ann and Joseph F. As Preston Nibley put it, at that time of his life, Joseph F. was quick with his temper and not afraid to let his fists fly. The only thing left to do was to call him on a mission to the Sandwich Islands. Joseph was only 15 and a half. But it should also be noted that Brigham Young's nephew, John R. Young, who was also called, was only a year and a half older. Nor would Joseph F. be without family members. His father's uncle, 74-year-old Silas Smith, was called and would be his first companion. And Silas's son, Silas S. Smith, was also in the group. Word that Joseph Smith's nephew and Brigham Young's son were coming to the islands preceded them. On their first Sunday in Honolulu, the native saints begged the mission president to have them speak. The Hawaiian social system was kinship-based, and they had, quote, made great calculations and speculations about them. When they were speaking, one missionary wrote, all eyes were fixed upon them and wondered at the wisdom and dignity with which the boys of 15 and 16 years spoke. Now remember, these are Hawaiians, and most of them don't even speak English. Another missionary wrote, young Joseph Smith was greatly venerated by the natives as being relative to the prophet. The islanders were not alone in venerating family ties. Many Utah Mormons believe that the Smiths constituted a priesthood lineage, that not only had they been chosen to lay the foundation of the earth, their descendants had a special destiny too. In 1857, Joseph's cousin, Ina Coolbrith, she was the daughter of Don Carlos and Agnes Smith, replied to a letter Joseph had written her. You speak truly, Joe, when you say that the highest blood in the world flows through our veins. I am proud of it, though not vainly so, and I thank God that he has bestowed upon us the name and blood of his chosen ones. Joseph was homesick for his first few months on the islands. He received no mail for 5 months. Not only was he an orphan, it must have seemed that he was friendless as well. Finally, a letter arrived from George A. Smith, his father's cousin, who would become Joseph F.'s mentor and almost surrogate father. Joseph reported his travels and his impressions of the islands. He noted that he had visited an Ephraim Green at the struggling colony on Lanai, and Green had asked him to pass on word that he was planting a personal vineyard there and would soon send him all the wine that you can drink. Many 19th century Mormons drank wine on special occasions and other alcoholic beverages as well, and many men chewed tobacco, including most Sandwich Island missionaries. And it seems that Joseph F. picked up both habits at 15 or 16 years of age. He was often served wine or liquor when he visited the whites on the islands, and tobacco became an addiction. In 1875, he wrote, from my childhood, for 20 years and upwards, I chewed the filthy weed. I never saw the moment during the whole time that I was not inwardly ashamed of it, insomuch as I endeavored to keep it to myself using great caution. One day I went into the president's office. He whispered to me. I was obliged to whisper back. He smelt my breath and started in surprise. Do you chew tobacco? I could have shrunk out of existence and annihilated myself from very shame. And he saw I was ashamed of myself, and pitying me, said, keep it to yourself. When I went out, I was resolved that I, who so hated hypocrisy, now thoroughly hating myself, would conquer my appetite for tobacco or know the reason why. I tried it with it in my pocket, but it was no use. My hand would involuntarily find and put it in my mouth, and it seemed when at last it was all gone, I vowed I would not touch it again. And all my friends were dead. I think he's talking about all his friends who used tobacco. All my friends were dead or gone on a journey. Everybody was cross and crabbed, including my amiable wives and loving children, and I had no very definite purpose in life. But I conquered, and now when I think of it, I feel ashamed that I was so weak. And strange to say, the appetite, though still with me and perhaps as strong as ever, is at my command. It is no longer the master, but a subdued, conquered enemy, ever on the alert to revolt, but daily growing weaker and more faint. This candid confession is pregnant with implications. For 20 years, he lived with shame. Every day when he reached into the pouch, he knew he was violating God's word. He condemned himself as a hypocrite, He became cross and irritable. It affected his family relations, and he even began to doubt his purpose on earth. I think it's hard for us to appreciate that kind of shame that he felt, but I don't think he was exaggerating his feelings. In October 1883, he acknowledged to the Salt Lake School of the Prophets that as a youth he had, quote, used tobacco and he loved liquor, but had quit and believed everyone who wanted to quit could do the same. There's no indication that he drank to excess, but his love of liquor must have contributed to the inner conflicts that helped ruin his first marriage. Returning now to Hawaii, his spiritual boot camp. For roughly 75 years before George Q. Cannon opened the mission, the native population had been decimated by white man's diseases. Most Hawaiians outside Honolulu lived in abject poverty, filth, and cultural disintegration. Over 4,000 embraced Mormonism when it first arrived. So many promises were made. But when a smallpox epidemic struck Oahu in 1853, the priesthood was ineffective. One-third of the saints died, just like their non-Mormon friends and relatives. By the time Joseph arrived, the members were demoralized. Many, if not most, seemed incapable of living in accordance with Mormon standards. The mission presidency decided to organize a gathering place on Lanai where members would be free of corrupting influences. The strongest members were called to be pioneers. Unfortunately, this left most branches without effective leaders. And the people also grumbled about demands for donations, on top of tithing, to purchase a boat and provisions for the colony. Demands on the new missionaries were also high. Mere survival was the first priority. Joseph and his companions sometimes went 2 or 3 days with nothing to eat. Learning the language is the second priority. Joseph learned the language quickly, and in 6 months was appointed president of the Maui Conference. At 16, he had responsibility for 3 or 5 older missionaries and 1,000 saints in 27 branches. Think of that, a 16-year-old who had just barely learned to speak the language. At such a young age, one wonders how he did it. Certainly, he applied himself. Joseph was always a hard worker, and necessity is an effective taskmaster. But there is also a dream that he reported 6 months before his death that he said he experienced at this time, early in his mission. The only source for this dream is Joseph Fielding Smith's biography of his father. There are, so far as I have been able to determine, no other references to it. Nevertheless, it is an interesting account. He was invited to a large mansion. When he knocked on the door, he was greeted by the prophet Joseph Smith. They shook hands, Joseph F. being physically aware of the prophet's hand. Also present were Hiram, Mary, Brigham, and others. Mary was holding an infant, and the prophet asked Joseph to bring it to him. As he passed the baby to the prophet, he purposely brushed against his chest to make sure this was not a dream. When he went back to retrieve the baby, he again pressed up against the prophet and felt the warmth of his belly. Both times, the prophet smiled at him knowingly. Now notice the interpretation Joseph F. places on this dream. It's not what you would expect. When I awoke that morning, I was a man, although a boy. There was not anything in the world that I feared. I could meet any man or woman or child and look them in the face, feeling in my soul that I was a man every whit. That vision, that manifestation and witness has made me what I am. If I am anything that is good or clean or upright before the Lord, if there is anything good in me, that has helped me out in every trial and through every difficulty. What Joseph gains from this experience is not a testimony of the gospel or of Joseph Smith or any of the usual things you might expect. He needs no assurance of those things because they are part of his being. At least 6 months before his death, I'm not sure he interpreted the dream at the same time in Hawaii. But what he longs for and what he gains in this experience is acceptance. He has been received into the royal household. Whatever the source of his faith, Joseph F. exhibited a rock-solid faith in the gospel and his own standing in the church. In 1857, while still on his mission, he wrote his cousin, Ina Coolbrith, in California, "You think the church is wrong. I aver most solemnly in the name of Jesus and the authority of the priesthood I hold, unless you awake, repent, and reform, God will blight your prospects, cross your path with sorrow and afflictions, and scourge you to humility and penitence. I do not care for the world nor its honors, no more than I do the bubbles that burst upon the bosom of the wave. I seek to write my name on the tablet of eternity, and instead of the laurels of human honor and the guilt of human praise, I seek to write it with the blood of Christ and my fathers." That's pretty good writing for an 18-year-old boy who's only had 3 months of education. He constantly practices penmanship and studies vocabulary, words, and grammar. His style is a bit overcooked by today's standard, but nonetheless, it was impressive. Joseph F. returned to Utah in February 1858, just in time to participate in the final stages of the Utah War. Incidentally, during part of that time, he served under Orrin Porter Rockwell. At first, his romantic attentions were focused on his sister-in-law, Jane Fisher, of Mill Creek. But he broke that off in February of 1859, perhaps at the urging of his stepfather and or George A. Smith, to court his 16-year-old cousin, Levira Smith. Levira was living in the home of George A. and Bathsheba Smith. She was well-educated, articulate, and clearly Joseph's intellectual superior. He was painfully self-conscious about his lack of education and his prospects. "It is with feelings of true emotion that I attempt to address you a few lines this morning. It is, however, without embarrassment and diffidence that I engage in this task. I say task because it is a task to me to delineate the feelings of my beating heart in writing. Still, 'twould be a pleasurable task could I but penetrate the future and see therein the completion and fulfillment of my ardent hope. But like the divinity of a Cato's immortality, shadows, clouds, and darkness hang about it. Since I saw you first, the admiration and respect I first conceived for you have grown daily, till they have changed to something stronger and more fervent. Still, I have not till very lately helped or dared to hope or encourage in the least the throbbings of my heart, knowing as I do and have known from the very first my situation in the affairs of life, the disadvantages of scanty means and inability to sum up all to see so many chances that are arrayed against me. But now I feel to ask myself, why this, nay, all these, should be permitted to impede the course of true affection, provided that my feelings were reciprocated. Not knowing, therefore, the state of your feelings, it becomes a duty that I owe to myself to simply ask you, cousin, how you feel toward me, what you think of cousin Joe, or whether it is agreeable to you or not that I should encourage further my desires or cease to know and or hope or dream of thee as something nearer, dearer, and more choice than just a cousin and a friend." Well, what 16-year-old girl could resist such a declaration? 38 days later, they were married. After a year of marriage, Joseph set off on another mission, this time to England, where he proselyted a few months, then served nearly 3 years as emigration agent for all European saints leaving for the States. George Q. Cannon was the mission president, and this was the beginning of a four-decade-long association. While Joseph was in England, Levira suffered from deprivation and what we would today call bipolar affective disorder, manic depression. George advised Joseph F. not to trouble himself about affairs at home. "For while on missions, we have to let those things out of our reach, take care of themselves. As near as I can tell, Joseph F. followed that counsel." Shortly before leaving England, Joseph adopted an 8-year-old orphan boy. We have descendant of that orphan boy with us. Would you just stand up to prove that this is true? Okay. Thank you, Lamont. When they reached home, Levira was in a manic state. The excitement of his arrival, plus, I assume, her sudden new responsibilities as a stepmother, aggravated Levira's condition. Joseph stayed up with her around 6 weeks before the episode subsided. Though bipolar disorder onset usually begins in the late teens and without medication persists throughout the patient's life, usually with increasingly severe episodes. The stress of sudden and extreme mood swings can destroy relationships, even when their causes are understood. When they are not understood, only the strongest ties could possibly weather the cycles. After 5 months in Salt Lake, Joseph F. left on another mission to Hawaii to retake it from Walter Murray Gibson and to establish a new gathering place at La'ia. In his absence, Levira moved to San Francisco, where she lived with Ina Coolabrith and her mother, while receiving medical attention that she didn't feel she could get in Salt Lake. Joseph spent 7 months settling affairs in Hawaii after which he had joined Levira in San Francisco. She wanted to remain there. He insisted they return to Salt Lake. She stayed. He returned. He never forgave her. He began to work as a clerk in the historian's office under George J. Smith and as a recorder in the Endowment House. He also began his 9-year tenure in the Territorial House of Representatives and spent several years on the Salt Lake City Council. Levira returned to Salt Lake in 1865, but their relationship continued to deteriorate. She hated polygamy, and Joseph was fully committed to it. In May 1866, she consented to his taking a plural wife, Julina Lamson, a niece of George A. and Bathsheba. 2 months later, Joseph F. was ordained an apostle. There not being an opening in the Council of the Twelve, however, the ordination was kept secret, especially from Heber C. Kimball for unknown reasons. 11 months after his ordination, Joseph and Levira agreed to separate. In a letter outlining her grievances to Brigham Young, Levira alleged what we might call emotional abuse and neglect. Among the specific incidents she cited was this one, that occurred in the fall of 1866. I came to my mother's and had been in bed 2 weeks when one evening I was able to sit up a little and Mr. Harris came home to supper. Levira's mother ran a boarding house where they both lived, and that's why Mr. Harris is coming in and having supper. And seeing me sitting up, said if I liked, he would come up and read to me. Soon after, Joseph came in, and seeing Mr. Harris reading to me, he called me a damn whore, a little-stained, illegitimate whore, and a liar. And if he ever caught a man in my room again, there would be bloodshed if he had to swing for it. He threw my chair back against the stove and opened the front door so that passersby could hear and said, Madam, if you want a divorce, I'll give you one. When I said, very well, I'll take it this evening. So he left the house. The next day he came down and apologized, said he was very sorry and did not want to give me a divorce, but would provide for me and let me live with my mother. I forgave him and tried to forget the past, but he did not do as he agreed to, never brought anything to me from home in the eating line or any other. Supposed I could live on mother altogether. Joseph F. replied, it was once while on the way to the city council, about 7 o'clock in the evening near the 4th of October. It was quite dark when I went into the house. There was a candle burning in the shed. Both inside doors were open, and by the reflection from the candle, I saw Levira and Mr. Harris sitting in close proximity by themselves in the dark. If he had been reading to her within an hour, it was from a book with raised letters, and he had read by hand. On seeing me, which was not until I could almost reach them, Levira drew back hurriedly, and Harris rose to his feet. I was now almost choked with anger and humiliation and could not contain my rage. I was therefore not responsible for what I said or did. Still, I remember everything distinctly. I do believe that if I had been armed, I would have done violence to him, and I told him so. I told her plainly her conduct was whorish and illegitimate. I did not call her a whore. I asked her if she was not ashamed of herself, or if she thought such conduct was becoming a married woman. And furthermore, whatever she thought of it, I considered it unbecoming and disgraceful, and so long as she was my wife, I would not allow it. And if ever I caught a stranger and a Gentile in her bedroom, under such circumstances, there would be bloodshed if I swung for it. She replied, "Then, Mr. Joseph F. Smith, give me a divorce. Mr. Harris is a perfect gentleman, and I'll take your divorce tonight." I did not open the door until I was about to go out. Then I shut it again and talked with her a few moments, then opened the door and went out. The next day I called to see her and tried to conciliate matters between us. She absolutely refused to be reconciled, except I would apologize to Mr. Harris. To this, every feeling in me revolted. Nevertheless, after considering the matter, I wrote a studied apology to Mr. Harris, as non-compromising as I could word it, regretting that I had lost my temper and had spoken harshly to my wife in the presence of a stranger. Levira accepted it, and things went on again as before, although a weight was upon my mind that almost disheartened me, for I saw where her course would lead her to. 2 weeks after receiving this reply, Brigham Young set Joseph apart as a member of the Council of the Twelve. Levira moved to California the next spring and obtained a divorce there on the uncontested grounds of polygamy. Also in 1868, Joseph F. married Sarah Ellen Richards, daughter of Willard Richards. They moved to Provo for a year while Joseph filled an assignment on the city council there. In 1869, he returned to Salt Lake and resumed his labors in the historian's office. We now arrive at 1872, the year Joseph wrote the recollection of his early life, the manuscript we've been talking about, the family myth. He was not getting along well with his neighbor, James McKnight. Actually, their relationship was really ugly. The two men hated each other, and the fact that McKnight had married one of Joseph F.'s cousins didn't help matters. On New Year's Day, 1873, Joseph went to McKnight's house, and a heated argument ensued, followed by a severe beating Joseph administered to his neighbor with a cane. Joseph later apologized, and McKnight accepted the apology. But at the April conference, according to the Tribune, Joseph F. said that he, quote, did not claim to be perfect, as he had many weaknesses. He was a passionate man, and had sometimes been, to a certain extent, overcome by it, but had not done anything criminal in that respect. But to a very limited extent. But apparently, the 1873 attack was a wake-up call for Joseph F., for it was the last violent act we know of. He got serious about controlling his temper and his appetites. A few months later, he wrote that letter that we mentioned about overcoming his habit of chewing tobacco. So he was in a reform mode. But his neighbor, McKnight, would not let matters rest. A year after his beating, he wrote Joseph F. a nasty letter, claiming his injuries were painful and permanent, and some doctors believe his life would be shortened. He also added, "Your lifelong plea of inherent and uncontrollable frenzy at the sight of some hobgoblin the heart of your temper has personified as a veritable traitor whose grim visage has poisoned your peace for a quarter century past is worn threadbare. It cannot any longer screen moral and mental imbecility. The drunkard who murders another under the plea that his minor madness will relieve the crime of its monstrosity exposes his disposition to commit the crime." Just mention that in this letter he says that Joseph F. had been complaining that he had this problem with anger for a quarter of a century, which is exactly the year that he arrived in the valley with his mother and had that experience with Cornelius Lott. The following year, that is in 1875, when Brigham Young was briefly jailed for polygamy, Joseph F. was on a mission in England. His wife, Julina, wrote, "I have felt thankful lately that you were in England. If you had been here the night the president was sent to mission, I think it would have riled that feeling you had born in you." Julina believed that his hot temper had been with him from birth. Joseph also had a reputation as a firebrand with his colleagues. In 1879, he lambasted Ogden saints who might be thinking of voting for Gentiles. "If you become negligent and get so damnably liberal as to invite the devil himself into your private chamber, holding God in one hand and the devil in the other, he will spew you out of his mouth. I know that some of our good, deliberate brethren will say, 'It is only Brother Joseph F. He is only a boy, and when he gets a little older and more experienced, he will see things a little differently, and we will excuse him because he is a little hot-headed.'" So we have come to the end of our tale. Our hot-blooded firebrand had overcome his addiction to tobacco and his love of drink. He managed to control his anger to the extent of suppressing violent tendencies. He demonstrated his devotion to the church in two missions to Hawaii and one to England, and was rewarded with full-time employment. He had gained administrative experience as an international immigration officer, city councilman, state legislator, and apostle. He had acquired extensive knowledge of church history in the historian's office and through his contracts with first-generation leaders. Finally, he entered into the everlasting principle of plural marriage, for which his father and uncle sacrificed their lives. The principle he defended and protected, suffered for, lied for, and eventually ended. Joseph Smith was a very complex man. Thank you.
No one more embodied, no one before or since his time more embodied the Latter-day Saint past or constructed its future than Joseph F. Smith. I concur with what Scott has said about his complexity, and I am grateful to Scott for undertaking this biography. He is Joseph F. Smith is a too much neglected figure from our past. His import, I think, is in part signified by the fact that his words will be our curriculum for the next 2 years in both Relief Society and Priesthood. He is indeed, I think, equal to Brigham Young, if not superior to Brigham Young in his influence upon the Latter-day Saint Church. So this is no small task that Scott has undertaken, I believe. My own studies of Joseph F. Smith come in the context of my dissertation, which is on the Reed Smoot hearings, and Joseph F.'s participation in those hearings are an integral part of my story, and particularly the allusion Scott made to lying for polygamy. So I come to this description of the first 30 years of Joseph F.'s life more familiar with the last 30 years of his life, and recognize that subjective wrinkle in my comments. So the biography that Scott is undertaking has, my first thought is, has a particular challenge in that he's dealing with an idealized figure. And we've seen this phenomenon in the last 30 years in American biography. It is difficult to bring idealized figures to life without focusing on their unidealized parts. Trying to get the reader to understand the person differently often means restoring to that person different facts and emphasizing them to the opposite extreme, if you will, or emphasizing the opposite facts to an equal extreme as the idealized parts. So to look at Joseph F.'s rage and to look at his violations of what we term the word of wisdom are part of that project of bringing Joseph F. to life. The challenge, of course, is going to be not to fall off the other side of the horse, you know. And also the challenge is to so contextualize those behaviors by Joseph F. Smith in his own time. So that why does it matter? Does it only matter to us as Latter-day Saints that he smoked and drank? Why should it matter to anybody else reading this biography? That's the challenge I think Scott has about these facts, is to say why they mattered. Otherwise, we're left as Latter-day Saints, kind of seeing him as a violator of the Word of Wisdom, knowing, even as we do, the complexity of the history of the Word of Wisdom during this time. So why does it matter? What does it say about him? And I see Scott trying to do this in this early draft of his work. And so the subjectivity of our judgment reading about these things leaves some of the language sounding stronger than it needs to be. For example, would we say he loved alcohol? Or does his expression that he loved alcohol evidence that shame that Scott has talked about? So what does it mean? The discipline of living an LDS life is very central to Joseph F.'s story, I think, as it is to our own, of course. And then there's this issue that Scott brings up in his letters, in Joseph F.'s letters to Levira. Is that how do you say Levira? And the exaggeration of terms really needs to be contextualized in 19th century thought and language. I'm not sure that his prose didn't sound canned to her, and should have, as a ritual expression of courtship in that period. So I don't know how much she would have been as swayed as your language implies. And being 16 years old in those days, I think that was more an expected time to receive these ritual proposals. I'm interested in what made her accept this. I can't assume that it's the language of that letter that would have induced her to do that, given their pedigree in that society. Nevertheless, I guess, having said those, nevertheless, the emotionalism in his life is extraordinary. And I agree with Scott in his decision to pick up on those themes. And so my next comment has to do with the psychological analysis that any biography undergoes. The challenge is not to let the theory overcome the life. And so when we look at Joseph F. Smith's anger, shame, and blame, I actually think the word rage is more accurate to describe what Joseph F. was going through. There's another incident he tells of on one of his trips to the East Coast. He bumps into a man who starts talking about the mob violence in Missouri, not knowing Smith's pedigree. And Joseph F. is thinking the man participated in the mob violence. And as he relates the account, says that he thanks God that he didn't have a gun on him. Again, it's another one of those incidents, like Scott said, that a man would have been dead. Because he realized that before the man had finished the conversation, he had his knife drawn. Again, a kind of trance, if you will. When Joseph F. gets into these places, we would use the word trance to describe it. And what I would suggest to Scott in this psychological analysis, that possibly the theory related to trauma incident to, or the stress related to post-trauma states is relevant to Joseph F. Smith. PST, post-traumatic stress, that's become such jargon, but applies not only to survivors of incest and child abuse, but to political prisoners and to veterans of war. The paradigm for each of those experiences, the psychological paradigm for each of those experiences, can fit Joseph F. Smith because he indeed experienced elements of each of those. And so I think that some of the discussion in that is helpful, particularly as it relates to powerlessness. That this was not a discipline issue, that maybe this expresses in Joseph F. a particular sense of powerlessness. That fits with this vision experience as empowering him in a particular way that brings him peace. But there is a fear and powerlessness that characterizes his life that he appears to be trying to compensate for all his life. And so when he says, when he looks back on that vision so many years later and says, after that vision, and there was nothing I feared, I think there's a key there. The roots of his rage I think, are properly understood in terms of this fear and powerlessness. He says in 1860, and I'm indebted to Scott for this, Scott's papers that he donated to the U, I've used in my own dissertation work, so I'm really just reminding Scott of what he knows when I say these things. But for you who haven't had the benefit of seeing there's a wonderful letter that Joseph F. writes to Levira in 1860 when he's 22 years old. And he is heading east on his way to England on a mission, and he passes through Nauvoo. I can't imagine a more poignant visit than the one he makes to his cousins and his aunt Emma, in Nauvoo at that period. And he writes Levira and he says, just a few sentences here, apropos of the powerlessness and the fear and the rage. He says, he tours Nauvoo. He says, he saw the little brick outhouse where I shut myself up to keep from going to prison, as I supposed. Now, he would have been, what, about six, maybe, in this time? Mm-hmm. So he's 6 years old, and he thinks they're going to take him to prison. And he goes and shuts himself up and hides in the outhouse. Think of shame and degradation and fear and guilt for hiding. He says, you have heard me speak of it, I think, often. And then he goes on. And so there's that very revealing bit of his past. Then he goes on and says to Levira, but me, she said, Emma, speaking of his aunt Emma, she would have known me anywhere, she said, because I look so much like father. And he puts an exclamation point after it. For all the emphasis on establishing the reputation of his mother, and I think Scott's absolutely right on that, I think the more complex question is, what did his father mean to him? And possibly the reason he speaks of his mother so much is that he may not have words for that. This could be something so inchoate in him that we have to look between the lines to understand what Hiram meant. So this is in the order of questions that I found Scott's paper, even in its draft form, very evocative. These are the questions it evoked, not because of its inadequacies, but because of the story that's yet to be told. What Scott's given us today are just the first 30 years of Joseph F.'s life. Imagine if someone were to look at your life in the first 30 years and try to... So today we're kind of left with that understanding of those first 30 years. The rest that's yet to come, I look for more on this question of how he became so articulate. You look at his sermons, and there is no one that can compete with him in his capitulate the doctrines of the kingdom. For his lack of education, for all his lack of education, it does not show. When he debates some of the most educated people in the country, when he sits before that Senate panel in 1904, the newspapers remark on how he holds his own in argument. It's extraordinary. So this question of how this mind developed is a very interesting one, because it's a fine mind. The complexity of his feelings towards his father. His love of the doctrines of the church. I don't know where he gets that, because he's the one that begins to theologize on Mormonism in a formal sense. He's the first one. It's an extraordinary contribution. His interest and capacity for doctrinal exegesis is remarkable. More about his experiences of his marriage and his children. I know that's going to come later in Scott's book, but a very profound contribution probably to humbling Joseph F. in his life, as it is for anybody who's a father and does it with any sense of heart. Then the burden of being the heir of the Smiths. I'm wondering why his brother John wasn't brought into the fold. Because Joseph F. later is so careful to include John as patriarch. So that's a mystery to me. I'm very interested in what Scott will have to say about the relationship between Joseph F. and John, and why the one is brought into Brigham Young's office and ordained, and then nurtured and succored. I was touched by Paul Edwards' comments last night about shunning in his own experience, and you can see the opposite happening to Joseph F. as a young man. He is brought in at a very young age and taught by those men to take over. And for whatever criticism you may have felt about Brigham Young and his dynastic impulses, and I, You have to include the knowledge that he brought in Joseph F. at the expense of his own children at that time. Quite an extraordinary move by Brigham. And also Heber J. So, Heber J. Grant. So, anyway, this is, using the word in its technical sense, I don't think you can find a more romantic figure in Mormon history unless you go back to his uncle and his father than you find in Joseph F. In terms of the powerful complexity, the depth of personality, and I am so grateful to Scott for what he's undertaken. Since we have emphasized today his rage, I think we can begin to appreciate now one of the greatest contributions he made to the saints at the turn of the century, which was telling them that they had to put that aside. We forget. Joseph F. so perfectly accomplished his task that we today have trouble even recognizing the legitimacy and the residual anger the saints must have felt in 1904 about the raid, much less what went on in Missouri and Nauvoo and crossing the plains and the privation and the violence that was endemic in their formative years. In 1902, he stands at the pulpit and he says to the saints, "Go from this conference to your homes, feeling in your hearts and from the depths of your soul to forgive one another, and never from this time forth to bear malice towards another fellow creature. I do not care whether he is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or not, whether he is friend or foe, whether he is good or bad. It is extremely hurtful, and he would know this." He was speaking out of his experience. "It is extremely hurtful to harbor a spirit of envy or malice or retaliation or intolerance toward or against one's fellow man. We ought to say in our hearts, 'Let God judge between me and thee.' But as for me, I will forgive. I will say to you that Latter-day Saints who harbor a feeling of unforgiveness in their souls are more guilty and more censurable than the one who has sinned against them. Go home and dismiss envy and hatred from your hearts. Dismiss the feeling of unforgiveness and cultivate in your souls that spirit of Christ which cried out upon the cross, 'Father, forgive them.'" I suggest to you that the benefit of looking at the rage and even that trance-like state of violence and the harboring of hurt and powerlessness that can so characterize Joseph F.'s life was also that weakness in him that became the pearl of revelation that the church needed at the turn of the century as it was required to integrate with American society. The saints had to put aside their grievances and their sense of injustice completely. And they did it so completely that today we can't even remember it as being there at the turn of the century. And we don't even make much about it in those earlier years. That's an interesting phenomenon about us. And I believe it's a contribution that in which you can measure Joseph F. Smith's prophetic power. That he both understood that requirement of forgiveness at being at the heart of the religious quest, that he cultivated it eventually in his own life sufficient that he could lead his people to that place. And again, I am so grateful to Scott for what he is undertaking here, because we need to remember this man and what he cultivated in himself and in us. Thank you.
We're out of time. We want to thank Scott and Kathleen for great papers, and we want to thank you for coming.